Asheville FM on WSFMLP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm your host today, William Goodenough.
What about me? I'm Bursts.
The show can also be heard on KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KXCF in Marshall, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be heard a week after broadcast at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can reach us for comments at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. If you care to write us a letter, please address it to The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. This show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Firestorm's full catalog of books and zines can be found online at firestorm.coop. This week on The Final Straw, Burst spoke with Beth, a member of Phoenix Anarchist Black Cross and a member of the Support Jesse B Committee, about the case of Jessica Burlow. Jesse is a now 18-year-old woman on the autism spectrum and diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder, who's been held in solitary confinement as a protective measure at the Maricopa County Jail. She's being charged by the state in the death during BDSM-style sex of her 42-year-old lover 2 years ago in what even coroners have deemed to be accidental. We talk about Beth's case, about gender in courts, about child welfare, mental health, and advocacy in the criminal system of Arizona. But first, these announcements.
Mason is an anarchist and environmental and animal rights prisoner serving nearly 22 years in federal prison for acts of sabotage carried out in defense of the planet. No one was injured in any of these actions. After being threatened with a life sentence in 2009, he pleaded guilty to charges of arson at a Michigan State University research lab, researching genetically modified organisms for Monsanto, and admitted to 12 other acts of property damage. The sentencing judge applied the so-called, quote, terrorism enhancement, unquote, to his term, which added almost 2 more years than the maximum requested by the prosecution. This is the harshest punishment of anyone convicted of environmental sabotage to date. Marius is incarcerated at the High Security Administration Unit of the Federal Medical Center Carswell in Fort Worth, Texas. According to the prison's own literature, the unit is, quote, designed for female inmates with histories of escapes, chronic behavior problems, repeated incidents of assault or predatory behavior, or other management concerns, unquote. Marius has never violated any prison rules. Clearly, he is being held in this unit because of his political beliefs and in an effort to silence him. The unit is frequently and unpredictably locked down for hours on end due to violence and suicide attempts resulting from the claustrophobic and oppressive conditions. Prisoners leave the building for medical treatment, but only after a protracted wait and fierce advocacy on the part of the prisoners, even though Carswell is ostensibly a medical facility. Access to mental health counseling, medical care, and educational opportunities are greatly diminished because of security reason issues. Due to the shifting policies, Marius unit is the only one accepting male. Due to shifting policies, Marius's unit is only accepting male addressed to Marie, in parentheses Marius Mason. This change has felt like a big step back in his plea to begin his transition. Mason is a transgendered man. Additionally, he has received little to no mail in the past 2 weeks, leaving him in almost complete isolation from the outside world. It's asked that people write to him to let him and the prison administration know that folks are keeping an eye on his situation. Addressed letters to Marie, in brackets Marius, Mason, 04672-061, FMC Carswell, Federal Medical Center, P.O. Box 27137, Fort Worth, Texas, 6127. More about him and his case can be found at supportmariusmason.org.
This is an update on anarchist prisoner Eric King's case. From his support website, we have just received word that Eric's trial is likely to be continued yet again. Eric's public defender has entered a motion to continue his trial date until March 8th. So that we can have more time to prepare for trial or otherwise resolve the case. We expect that the judge will grant the motion. As you may know, it's been over a year since Eric's arrest and pretrial incarceration at CCA Leavenworth, a private prison operated by the Corrections Corporation of America in Leavenworth, Kansas. Although for Eric and the rest of us, it feels like it's been a very long time, for the trial of this caliber, it's pretty standard to spend a couple of years in prison awaiting trial. Many warm thank yous to all those who have been making preparations to come to Kansas City for the trial. We hope to be able to give plenty of notice so that people can make clear plans to attend trial and show their support. We hope that should Eric's case go to trial, friends and comrades will fill the courtroom. We are also happy to report that Eric's mail situation seems to be improving. Thanks to all the efforts of people across the country to pressure the CCA mailroom to abide by the laws it purports to uphold. Although we dream of a world without laws or rights, in the meantime, we'll do what we can to keep our friends' mail out of the trash. Thanks to all of those who are willing to join in the effort. For now, you can help by writing Eric a letter, hosting a letter-writing night for him, donating money to his legal fund, or buying a t-shirt. The road before us is long and expensive, and it's going to take a lot of support to get through it. Again, many thanks to all of you who have continued to show your support throughout this arduous process. You can see more about Eric's case at supporericking.wordpress.com, and you can write Eric a letter by addressing mail to Eric King, 270-90045, CCA Leavenworth, 100 Highway Terrace, Leavenworth, Kansas, 66048.
And this in from a rally.org page, a fundraising site that is being used by supporters of John Ye Waller, arrested in an obvious case of racial profiling in which the cops said he, quote, fit the description, unquote, of a crime he did not commit. A witness of the crime immediately confirmed that John Ye had nothing to do with it, but John Ye was still taken into custody, where he was questioned and then leveled with serious charges related to last year's protests in Oakland against the non-indictments for the murders of Michael Brown and Eric Garner. John Ye Waller is a young black activist, a local of the San Francisco Bay Area. He lives and works in Oakland, providing financial support to his mother, his two younger brothers, and his cousin. He attended Berkeley Community College, where he planned to major in accounting, but had to take leave in order to help support his family, and he hopes to return to college soon. John Ye also volunteers at a social center in West Oakland that works to empower black and indigenous people living in the Bay Area through education and mutual aid. Within this space, John Ye works tirelessly, helping coordinate and administer programs, focusing on skills like urban farming, which foster both community and individual autonomy. John Ye is the only person who is currently facing charges, serious charges, after thousands of people flooded the streets during the wave of protests in the Bay Area last winter. After several high-profile police killings of young black men, the Bay Area, like much of the rest of the country, surged into a wave of protest and resistance. The state responded by using the legal system as a tool of repression, threatening incarceration and steep fines for some of those involved in these actions. It is sad but obvious that the one person getting targeted for the beautiful moment of protest is a strong and politicizing young black man. It's going to take time and money to fight these charges. The legal process saps significant resources. Johnny needs help with the costs of legal defense and the substantial bail amount that he borrowed. Other ways that one can help, other than donating on the rally.org page and searching for John Ye Waller. You can come out to support him in court. He has a court date on Monday, October 19th at 9 a.m. at the Wiley Manual Courthouse, Department 115 in Oakland. You could also help John Ye find a stable job. Get in touch. You can get a hold of support at freejohnye@gmail.com. That's J-A-N-Y-E.
In Anarchy Radio News, check out this newly minted podcast, The Brilliant, which is recorded out of Berkeley, California, and features co-hosts Aragorn of Little Black Heart, an anarchist publishing house, and Bellamy, formerly of Free Radical Radio. The Brilliant self-describes as, quote, an attempt to tell different kinds of stories, ones with complex moral plays, ones that aren't so clearly stories, and ones that are of human size. Their motivation to tell these tales is a desire to see a proliferation of different stories and not just the simple morality plays of popular culture or the inverted but otherwise identical stories of the radical milieu, unquote. Check out their archives and stay tuned for upcoming episodes at thebrilliant.org.
Now, some words by anarchist prisoner Sean Swain, held in media blackout at Warren CI in the belly of the beast of the Ohio Department of Retribution and Corruption, as read by Rydra of Free Radical Radio. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? We're caught like a wolf! Prison toilet. Bowel movements in prison will never be the same. Early September, administrators here at Warren Correctional Institution hired private contractors to install timers on the flushing mechanisms on prison toilets. The contractors came cell to cell, and we now have those big steel boxes the size of microwaves with a kind of raised steel button of sorts, the size of a half dollar. That's what you press to flush the toilet. I'm not making this up. I swear I'm not. So, this is how the timer works. You get one flush every 5 minutes. If you hit the flush button a second time before the 5 minutes expire, the toilet will flush, but you cannot flush the toilet for another hour. Essentially, if you flush twice in somewhat rapid succession, you get an hour-long penalty. This may not seem like a really big deal, but consider, this is a level 3 facility. We have 2 prisoners to a cell. Aside from meals and recreation and in-pod activities, we're locked down 2 to a cell, roughly 12 to 14 hours a day. During those hours, frequently, the garbage that goes in has to come out. Typically, somebody using the toilet facility to dispose of solid waste will engage in a short checklist of courtesies to accommodate the other prisoners locked in the room. It's standard practice, for instance, to hang a sheet from the mirror across to the bed frame. Also, if anyone has any prayer oil, a prospective user will burn a small amount on the lamp to mask the smell. The final courtesy, of course, is frequent flushing in order to keep down the odor. Well, that's out. And irony of ironies, the Warren Correctional Commissary has been out of stock on prayer oil for months. If we didn't know better, we'd almost have to think that somewhere in offices with the shades pulled, some diabolical administrators have conspired to force the prisoner population to smell our cellmates' bowel movements. They're not trying to turn us into model citizens, they're trying to turn us into poop sniffers. Rather than produce smart sellers, they're resolved to produce smart smellers. The rationales put forward for this offensive plumbing modification are superficially sensible, but are really bogus under any scrutiny. First, administrators claim that the toilet timers will prevent prisoners from using the toilet to flood the ranges. The timers certainly serve that purpose, but it's a solution to a non-problem. I've been locked up for 25 years. I've never been in population and seen a cell flood. That's stuff that goes on in segregation or other lockdowns, and Warren now only has 2 3B level blocks out of 12. It makes no sense at all to expect water sport uprisings from 3A level prisoners. Also, keep in mind that anyone who really wants to flood the block can simply pop the sprinkler and release thousands of gallons of water under high pressure. The second reason for toilet timers is that administrators say they will save money. I'm skeptical. No telling what the contract costs to install these devices in every cell, or what the long-term cost will be to maintain them, or how much water they'll save now that they've forced prisoners to maintain trash cans full of water from the sink to act as an additional flush when poured into the toilet. My guess is, saving from the water bill will be negligible. The fact of the matter is this, the control freak, seeking the total and complete subjugation of every aspect of human life, come to the realization that prisoners' bowels were functioning without any regulation at all, a completely chaotic, willy-nilly situation. So hierarchs in suits with stopwatches come to conclude that 5-minute timers would effectively regiment the operations of our lower intestines. The powerful elite have come to recognize that all of us at the bottom of the pyramid cannot be trusted with so much as the responsibility for exercising free will in the disposal of our own body weight. I bet the next application will be a helmet that yanks our jaws up and down, forcing us to chew each bite 32 times. Prison officials will, after all, have to take command of our entire digestive tract. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain, forcibly silenced by prison officials whose home addresses are posted at blastblog.noblog.org. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address by directing it to Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. President in 2016, And more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
We're speaking with Beth from Phoenix Anarchist Black Cross and the Free Jesse Support Group. Thanks a lot for coming on the air.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell listeners about Jesse Berlew, who she is?
Yeah, absolutely. Jessica Berlew is, she's currently 18, but she was 16 when she was arrested and when her whole situation came to our attention. She is a teenager living in Phoenix, Arizona. And she has her whole life been diagnosed with some neurodivergence around like schizoaffective disorder and being on the autistic spectrum. She's been raised by a single mother who has been largely cut off by support from family and friends. So it's been pretty much the two of them against the world. And they've run into a lot of issues with the way that the systems that are supposed to be support networks pretty much entirely fail for most families. So in their case, you know, they had a lot of failures in the school system, a lot of failures from the supporting mental health that was available on you know, Medicare, Medicaid provided insurance. They also had issues with the what was in Arizona CPS and then became the Department of Child Safety. It was basically a revamp done by our former governor to allegedly fix issues with the existing system, but really just slap a new label and a new brand on it and say that things are better. And they were caught right in that transition, which was a low point in an already failing system. Jesse has been kicked out of school, taken, you know, into involuntary mental health treatment and then taken back out 24 hours later, basically to make a checkpoint on a DCS checklist multiple times. And at the time that we became aware of Jesse, what had happened was that she had been removed from her home and put into a group home. Very typical in the Phoenix area for these group homes for teenagers to be extremely dangerous environments. With a lot of violence and drug use and a lot of underpaid, undertrained staff that aren't really capable necessarily of providing a safe or supporting environment for the teenagers living there. And it's very, very common for teenagers to run away and have nobody looking for them. So in this kind of environment, Jesse did run away. She was afraid to go home, afraid to be picked up again by DCS, and so was living largely on the street. And with friends and things, and she met a 43-year-old man online in an internet forum who presented himself as is being in his 20s. And he offered her some safety, some security, and they began a relationship, which for a lot of people, that's probably a pretty recognizable storyline. There's a lot of things that we have to do sometimes to survive and to find security in each other when there's, you know, when that's something that's been fairly well denied to us. This person, Jason Ash, also began giving Jesse heroin and meth and really exploiting the relationship and introducing her to a BDSM relationship, but obviously a real BDSM relationship doesn't have really gross and negligent power imbalances. This relationship obviously did, with Jesse being very dependent on him for security and safety and shelter. So during the course of this relationship, she was, you know, staying intermittently with him and staying on the streets. And they engaged in some sex acts that where he, at his request, had her wrap a cord around his neck. One of the times that he did this, he told her he'd tell her a safe word if he thought that he was going to lose consciousness. But a lot of people that are familiar with that kind of lifestyle know that that's not a safe way to engage with breath play, that you probably won't realize you're about to lose consciousness. And in his case, he lost consciousness and he didn't regain it. Jesse stated it in all the police reports that she did not realize that there was anything wrong until it was too late. And crime scene photos also support that. It looks like he lay down on the couch or lay down on the bed and fell asleep. He was twice her size. He could have overpowered her. He could have easily removed the cord from his neck. I don't think he realized he was in trouble until it was too late. So unfortunately, we have a, you know, a convergence of all of these different, you know, safety nets and alleged, you know, things that were supposed to protect and help children have like a healthy and safe environment and ability to grow up. And none of them worked in this case. But what happened to compound that was that the Phoenix police arrested Jessie and charged her. The county attorney charged her with second degree murder as an adult. Arizona's juvenile justice system is not great. It's not that there's a better option that actually provides justice, but the juvenile system does actually provide family counseling, long-term support for mental health. It looks at a bigger picture as far as, you know, what does this family need, which is how do we make this a safer and healthier environment. But instead of putting her into that system, if there was any reason to criminalize her, which there isn't, the county attorney went straight to the adult system, which what that meant was that Jessie Burley was arrested. She was put in an adult jail, one of the worst jail systems in the country, Maricopa County, run by Joe Arpaio, and for her own safety, put into solitary confinement. So for the last 2 years, she spent almost the entire time pretrial in a cell, 23 hours a day. She's out 1 hour a day, but not outside of walls, not out in the sun. And for a lot of it, denied any human contact except for corrections officers. So we became aware of her case because the media really sensationalized it. All of the headlines were like, goth teen kills boyfriend. And they had this huge focus on her having blue hair or piercings or, you know, listening to underground music, and no emphasis at all placed on the age difference, on the power imbalance in that relationship. Most of the stories portrayed the Jason Ashe as though he was her equal or of the same age as her, when he was actually 27 years older than her. And it clearly, you know, he picked Jessie for the reason of the ability to exploit her, to exploit that power relationship. She was extremely vulnerable, and he made the decision to engage in that way to take advantage of those kind of vulnerabilities. And the media, you know, furthered that exploitation. The court system furthered that exploitation, and essentially, she was just going to be thrown away like so many other kids in foster homes and in DCS care that are too much trouble to support, too much money to support, that require resources the state doesn't actually care about providing. So working with the Phoenix Anarchist Black Cross, this case was brought to our attention by another really great local activist, Peggy Plews with Arizona Prison Watch. And we decided to start a long-term jail support campaign, but it was a little different because she's pre-conviction, which actually gave us some hope that there might be an opportunity to change some of these media narratives and draw attention to this case in a way that is not easily done with post-conviction cases. Obviously, most Anarchist Black Cross branches focus on political prisoners, but I would make the strong argument that there's a lot of important political context in a story like Jessie's, and that we have to look at who are the victims of state and the victims of these hierarchies of oppression beyond the most overt political players. As kind of a counterpoint, like the local ACLU never really engaged strongly on this case. And partly because they kept saying, we don't engage on criminal cases, we engage on civil cases. And not that I think that the definition of civil rights leaves a lot lacking, but there's plenty of civil rights aspects to this case. As radicals, as anarchists, we have an obligation to go further than those very bare minimum liberal definitions of what is political and what is not, and actually see that, you know, so many systems of oppression are at play in criminalizing children like this and punishing them for their survivorship of some pretty extreme situations.
So we can see, like, very clearly a motivating factor for the media in bringing up the case and blowing it up in this very specific way, because it sells newspapers, it sells advertising, it sells, like, you're getting people to pay attention to this very, very extreme case of, like, homeless junkie, goth kid, kills her boyfriend in nasty sex act, blah, 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 you know, like, how they're going to spin it. Is the media coverage what you consider to be, like, a motivating factor for the prosecution of Jesse by the state, or do you see other motivating factors as to why the state would be proceeding in this manner, other than like providing services costing more than what something that they want to provide?
Right. Well, partially, but also, you know, Arizona has a well-earned reputation for the way that the state engages and sees itself as a tough on crime state, and it's echoed throughout a lot of state programs. The county attorney here, Bill Montgomery, actually has a pretty strong track record for sending juveniles to adult court and bypassing that juvenile system, which on paper shows that all these resources exist, but that means nothing if they're actually being denied to the people that need them the most. He also has a long history of sending survivors of domestic violence situations to court and criminalizing them. So this is part of an ongoing pattern on his behalf, but also with the media, this is coming in. Jesse's arrest came in on the tail end of the Jodi Arias trial, which was highly publicized. And I think that there's a existing misogynist concept around, you know, these dangerous and subversive women that will seduce and murder you. And it played into that narrative so well right after Jodi Arias. And they intentionally tried to play it along this, you know, the seductive murderess theme, that women are precocious, sexually precocious in a way that is dangerous to middle-aged men, you know, and they just can't control themselves and they're just not safe from these women. And it's, you know, so it's part of echoes of the much larger systems at play in American society, too.
So sort of a Black Widow theme.
Absolutely.
How
yeah.
Original.
Yeah, exactly. We, you know, Americans love that kind of storyline. And it's sort of amazing on the outside of it to tell the story and to say that the media presented it as her killing her boyfriend, instead of actually reflecting on any of the facts of the case. But that was the case was so simple in the early reports. There were zero reports that actually took a look at the factors of this case and whether or not his death was accidental and whether or not he was the main player in it leading to that outcome. Everything was aimed at how weird she was, this, you know, a freak teenager who killed her boyfriend. So there was just no counter narrative at all. So that was what we focused on first, because it seemed like something we could potentially have leverage on was putting out a counter narrative. We put up together our own press release and our own like letter to journalists, urging them to look at journalistic standards around juvenile victims of sexual abuse and assault and exploitation. And one thing that was really helpful in our approach was we started the spinoff group, the Free Jesse B group, as sort of a middle ground for people that maybe didn't identify themselves as an anarchist, but understood and could recognize the elements of the case and support it. Most of the people working on that support team are anarchists, but it was easier for us to reach people. And at the same time, it was very important that we didn't sacrifice any of our ideals in the way that we framed it. We didn't want to advocate, for instance, for Jesse being placed in some state-sponsored mental health care, some involuntary incarceration of a different form. We didn't want to criminalize her mother for not being able to, you know, provide enough safety and security as these kind of her power to do that was being taken away by the state. There were a lot of things that were really important to us that they were presented in a way that was not undermining other things we were fighting for. And we were able to do that and present it in a context that was more accessible maybe to non-anarchists, non-radicals. And we started to gain a lot of support. And we started to get more positive media coverage. We even got some of the old articles changed and their headlines changed.
This is The Final Straw on Asheville FM, and we're speaking with Beth of Phoenix Anarchist Black Cross and Support Jesse D Committee about the case of 16 or now 18-year-old Jessica Berlew in Phoenix, Arizona. More after this musical break. We're about to hear Chelsea Wolfe with the track Survive from the 2015 album Abyss.
You said you won't break my heart.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Beth, a member of Phoenix Anarchist Black Cross and a member of the Support Jesse B Committee.
So you mentioned how you were talking about how y'all were able to change how the media covered, like desensationalize the case somewhat or refocus some of the points of media coverage. Can you talk about how it's been with the attempt to get actual like legal defense in a court setting for Jessica and where that's at?
Yes. So a lot of the work we were doing at the beginning around creating that counter narrative was building a foundation of support. We were able to get to a point where we could provide more meaningful jail support because of that. So as our networks grew and more people became aware of the case, we were able to tap more and more people in, and they tapped in people in their networks, and it became, you know, a much further reaching conversation. And we were talking to lots of people in the legal system about ways to help or ways to approach this case. But one of the things that's very difficult is that a murder case costs a lot to defend. Even just on the basis of paying expert witnesses, it costs thousands and thousands of dollars. And so it's not quite the same as when we have a protest arrest that we're supporting, and you know, a lawyer could take it pro bono. If a lawyer took this case pro bono, they would be committing to paying tens of thousands of dollars out of their pocket, which most of them are not going to be able to do. But we kept trying to put pressure on, you know, finding more affordable counsel, as, you know, hoping that someday there would be some kind of option available. And finally, a little over, you know, two months ago, Jessie was offered a plea agreement. Initially, she told us she wasn't planning to take it. They were telling her it was for negligent homicide, which basically means accidental death. But at the time, she did not want to take it. She wanted to go to trial. And then she called her mother the day before she was supposed to take the plea and said, my lawyers are saying that I really need to take it. And her mom said, I still feel like you have a better chance at trial, you know. But she said, no, I'm going to take my lawyer's advice on this. And then the next day, we were fairly shocked when the plea turned out to actually be 10 years, no option of early release for second-degree murder. So for a lot of us and the, you know, the friends and comrades in the legal system, this didn't play out like a plea. This played out like what she would have gotten if she'd gotten convicted at trial. It wasn't a better option than going to trial in a lot of instances. And that plea was so shocking that it really galvanized some of our legal network comrades into trying to find a way to mitigate that. And what happened is we got an offer from somebody who had been putting pressure on a friend of theirs that is a criminal defense lawyer. And that person said, okay, I will take this case, but it does need to cover the cost of the witnesses. There would be a lot of expert witnesses involved in the case. It's complicated. And they said, I can take it for $10,000 on retainer and, you know, another $10,000 overall. But now that the plea had been taken, that meant we had 30 days until the sentencing to retain that new lawyer. And that's a lot to accomplish in 30 days. But we were like, well, it is absolutely worth trying. We've built this network of support. We have a lot of people that are now paying attention to this case and following along. Let's try versus not trying. And we just launched this fundraiser campaign, and we worked our tails off for a month. And we did everything from benefit shows to bake sales. We ran the fundraiser online. We posted several times a day, every single day. And really stretched the capacity of our networks. And we raised the $10,000 in just a little over 3 weeks. And that has completely changed our outlook on not only Jesse's case, but our outlook on our capacity as anarchists and radicals doing prison and jail support to, you know, accomplish some pretty incredible things and tap in people that maybe have not, you know, been so radicalized yet that they've necessarily been in our immediate networks. We were really very impressed and encouraged by the amount of support that came from our community locally, from people across the country, from people that were prison support advocates in the UK, all over. And it almost all the donations were about $10 or $20. It was really just accomplished by really stretching and getting as many people tapped in as possible. So now we are in the phase where Jesse's sentencing got pushed back slightly. It's still scheduled for later this month. And in this phase, we can't discuss too much about the defense strategy because we don't want to undermine it in any way. But we are much more encouraged about the direction it's going and Jesse's ability to be involved in her own advocacy and really have a voice and be included in what is going on with her legal team. And this is a totally different perspective than where we were at a year ago when we, you know, when we started trying to raise support for her a little over a year ago.
Well, that's really amazing that you were able to raise the money so fast. Yeah, I remembered hearing about it, and we did a couple of announcements on the show here, and then I heard from a mutual friend of ours that, like, hey, they raised the money, which is astounding. So when you were talking about the legal team or Jessica's legal support or lawyers right now who talked her into taking that plea deal that was definitely not to her benefit, those are public defenders. Is that right?
They are. And I want to be clear that we definitely appreciate the work of so many public defenders and do not want to undermine the importance of public defenders and their capacity to really, really help a lot of folks and the fact that they do help a lot of folks. In this particular case, for a lot of reasons that we can be more clear about later on as things unfold, we don't feel like that relationship was very supportive of Jesse, very inclusive of Jesse, or really gave her much of a say in what was going on at all. And, you know, on the plus side, that also gives more support and ability for a hard look at what happened and the ability for the case to take a different direction. But I'm sort of intentionally vague because I have to protect her defense strategy at this point. But I would not say that this is necessarily reflective of all public defenders. I know some really great and amazing public defenders who have done amazing work to help people the best they can within the legal system. But in this scenario, none of us were very impressed with the level of advocacy that they gave.
Yeah, and not to totally counter what you're saying, but the experience that I've heard from a lot of people who've gone through the legal system is that well-intentioned or not, public defenders have a huge caseload. There's more resources and more individuals invested in prosecution of individuals by the state, partially because it politically supports tough-on-crime perspectives and looks like the government is being efficient as opposed to actually trying to get to the bottom of whatever circumstances. And so, like, lacking hours, lacking money to be able to invest into those sort of, like, witnesses that would need to be got to defend someone, spend the hours researching law and looking for precedents. Like, considering the caseload of a lot of public defenders, a lot of them end up pushing people towards, as I understand it, pushing people towards taking a plea, even if going to trial would be more beneficial.
Yes. And one thing that's interesting about Arizona is that what you're saying is totally correct for most states, but Arizona, surprisingly, at least in Maricopa County, has a fairly well-founded public defense team. However, it's also a county where 96% of cases go to plea. So it speaks to not only, you know, do they have too many cases on their caseload, but also is there a hegemonic culture of taking a case to trial taking a case to plea and not building those trial skills and not necessarily having a team of lawyers who are prepared and capable to take a big case like this to trial. That was one of the things that came up quite a bit from folks that we know that are more inside that system, that there is a very strong likelihood that the public defender she had never taken a murder case or any case of such serious implications to trial. And so even with the funding, if there isn't a culture that's encouraging them to have trial skills and to use them when it's appropriate, it's it's still undermining that whole public defense system and its ability to actually do good and support people.
Well, thanks for the specification. I'm kind of surprised to hear that about Maricopa County, considering all the other things that I've heard about the legal and so-called justice system in that county. So,
yeah, I was surprised as well, to tell you the truth. It's easier to cut them slack, honestly, if it was a budget constraint. I feel less apologetic for them in this case because it wasn't a budget constraint.
So how long did you say that that Jessica Burleigh's been in solitary? What are the reasonings that the prison, the jail there is giving for protective status and putting into putting her into solitary? And what do you think some of the implications of that or outcomes of putting someone in her condition into solitary are?
Well, absolutely. A lot of it comes from her not only being a juvenile, but being a juvenile who is neurodivergent. Everything is framed as though it is for her own protection. But also she is constantly being punished by the system. She's given restrictions almost on a daily basis for things that seem pretty ridiculous to have a restriction for. For instance, she's not allowed in a lot of times to have pencils because she's on almost perpetual suicide watch. The reasoning for her being on suicide watch is that she has scars from self-mutilation, but that doesn't justify denying somebody any access whatsoever to pencils and paper and, you know, any kind of diversion from being in a cell all day. That is only going to contribute to, you know, her feelings of isolation and inability to parse what she's experiencing. She's been through an extreme trauma, and instead of receiving any kind of trauma counseling and support, she has been immediately locked into an environment that is so restrictive and limiting and so isolating. But everything is framed as though it's for her own protection. They're keeping her safe. For the first 20 months, she did not have really anybody in her ward. Every once in a while, there was another juvenile on her ward, but even then, they wouldn't be able to see each other. They could only hear each other. Now that she's turned 18, she has a few more people in her ward, and that has been an improvement as far as her outlook and her ability to survive what she's going through. But still, she's still in a cell 23 hours a day. And that's, you know, there's been lots and lots of things written up, especially ACLU has done extensive research on the effects of solitary confinement on juveniles and the effects of solitary confinement on folks who already are neurodivergent. But there's a lot of arguments and research also showing that solitary confinement itself can cause some pretty serious mental breaks for the obvious reason that you're trying to survive an extreme situation you were never intended to be put in. Now, when I say ACLU, also that's ACLU nationwide. Our local ACLU has not engaged much on her conditions of confinement. They've done a couple in-jail interviews and done one media statement about that. But that's, you know, again, the kind of system that could have been a better security net, a better safety net to catch these kind of cases and use them to build support for other juveniles experiencing similar things, and has not been the case with the Arizona ACLU.
For folks that aren't familiar with the terminology around neurodivergence, can you briefly break down what that means or what that's referring to?
Sure. There's a tendency around mental health issues to refer to people in a way that casts them outside of our definitions of normal. And it's really important that we don't have a normal. It's similar to other struggles where there's a default that is society set and not actually set by who humans are and what we are like. And so there's a lot of intense pressure to present as normal, to behave as normal, when normal itself is suspect. So neurodivergence is a term that a lot of folks use to kind of draw attention to the fact that differences in our neurology are what is causing people to be cast out and excluded, not things that are wrong with them. This isn't something that this person is flawed or has something wrong with them and it needs to be fixed or can be fixed. It's that this person is different from people that have been termed normal. And for that reason, they are being criminalized, oppressed, excluded, and not being, you know, especially in Jessie's case where her neurodivergence has only been used to further her isolation and her criminalization. It has not been used at all to provide better support and give her access to resources that she needs. It has only been used against her.
So you've talked about how, at this point, the legal defense team has a strategy they're working on and they're getting ready to take next steps. How can other people that are out in the listening audience, the wider audience, either offer support or keep more informed about the case? What's needed from the wider public?
Well, strongly encourage following the support website, which is freejessieb.org. And the Facebook page, which is also under facebook.com/freejessieb, because as those things unfold, we are going to launch some more calls to action. But right now, again, we don't want to in any way undermine the defense strategy by revealing too much. But what we will be needing around the terms of a trial situation is we will need to continue to raise funds to cover those expert witnesses. The lawyer involved has said that they are not interested in making a profit in any way off this case. So if we reach a point where we don't need to raise to the number we anticipated, then they will say we're good. We don't have to raise any more money. But right now we're anticipating that as being another $10,000. The other thing, though, that people can help with is stretching their networks to find witnesses that would be very helpful in this case without, again, undermining other people fighting similar fights. Experts on mental health and childhood trauma and, survival sex and these types of scenarios that are not going to present this in a way that criminalizes sex workers or criminalizes mental health or puts blame for neurodivergence on the family. Those types of experts are what we're looking for. And the lawyer is very open to us helping find those types of experts and making sure that this case is helping Jesse, but also not undermining others. So we're stretching our networks for that. We also are providing some paralegal and filing and research services so that the lawyer doesn't have to hire a team. So if there are law students, paralegals, people in the legal system that are in Arizona and are available or interested in helping, or outside of Arizona and have a way that they can help remotely, this is very much a all hands on deck scenario. It's surprisingly horizontal for being a criminal defense case. There's a lot of potential for us to figure out how to use this case as a launching point for other prison and jail support cases that we're doing, and really expand our ability to tap in others and find meaningful ways to support.
Are there ways for, or is it suggested that people engage Jesse by like sending in letters or sending like letters of support to her mom or anything like that, in addition to professional and economic ways of support that they can offer?
Yes. We actually, now that she's moved into the adult system, we have the ability to get more books into her. So we're about to push a book list up for folks that want to try to order her in books from like Amazon or something, obviously within the parameters of what the jail allows to be sent in. And then we do give out her address for writing to her, but on request only because of the sensationalization of this case. We occasionally get commenters or trolls that are pushing a very extreme and negative perspective on Jesse as a person, on subculture, lifestyles, etc. So that kind of thing we're trying to still shield her from, in accordance with her wishes and her mother's wishes as well. Her mother's been very, very involved with the support team efforts. And, until Jesse herself actually feels like she is okay with just taking, any and all letters, we're trying to just give it out like as asked. But if you hit up the support team at support@freejessieb.org, we can provide that information, or if you hit us up at the Facebook page. And we do have a lot of folks that have been writing to her, and she really appreciates that. She does have an easier time reading print letters versus cursive, and she really likes it when people draw pictures for her. So, if you're an artist at all or have a minute and can send her a postcard. She's on postcard restriction, so we can give you all the information about that as well if you hit us up for her address.
And outside of the just straight up donations that are available for giving off the freejessieb.org website, y'all are selling a bunch of merch too, right?
We are. We made we silkscreen t-shirts. And, you know, locally we've been doing things like bake sales and benefit shows and things, and we'll continue to do that. We also had a lot of people that did their own benefit shows in whatever capacity they could in their own towns. So groups out of Utah, out of California, out of New York City. So if this is something that you feel like you've got a support group that you want to, you know, do a benefit show or, you know, whatever, there, you know, there was even a really cool art show done down in Tucson by a group called Hey Baby Art Against Sexual Violence. And they featured Jessie's artwork and poetry and shared her story. So, you know, creative ways to bring people in on the case and you know, the, all of that is appreciated. It really has been so many people to get to this point. There's no way that you could isolate this down to just a few individuals. It would have been impossible without the amount of people that really jumped in and found a way to contribute to it.
Well, Beth, is there anything else that we didn't get around to that you'd like to cover?
No, you know, I guess just the most important thing I think is to recognize that we know about Jessie because of the media exploitation, but there are countless other children, teenagers, young adults, adults being similarly criminalized and exploited by the same legal system and the same, you know, failure to provide services and resources, but, you know, quick tenacity to criminalize and lock people away. And it's really important that in spite of all of the complications of this case, that we don't look at Jessie's case as though it's an outlier. It's really not. There's so many teenagers right now that are AWOL from shelters and living on the streets because they're trying to seek their own security and safety in a very, very broken system. So, you know, as much as possible, we need to find ways to provide sustainable, long-term, accessible support to, you know, all of the people that are surviving these systems and not look at Jessie's cases isolated.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to have the conversation. Good luck to all of you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for elevating the story and giving a boost to our signal. We really appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Beth, a member of Phoenix Anarchist Black Cross and a member of the Support Jessie B Committee, about the 18-year-old woman on the autism spectrum facing undue state repression for an accidental death. Asheville FM on WSFMLP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm your host today, William Goodenough.
What about me? I'm Bursts!
The show can also be heard on KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KXCF in Marshall, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be heard a week after broadcast at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can reach us for comments at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. If you care to write us a letter, please address it to The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. This show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Firestorm's full catalog of books and zines can be found online at firestorm.coop.